Thank you for listening to How It Ends. If you'd like to support the show, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/howitendsstudio. Our tiers start at $1, and all patrons receive early access, ad-free episodes, digital downloads, access to polls, and more. Physical rewards start at $6 and feature exclusive, patron-only merch and other perks. You can also visit us at howitendspodcast.com to shop in our merch store or to join our Discord server, where you can chat with us and other fans of the show. It's the only place you'll find exclusive whispers from Micah, Elia, Devin, and Amy. Please enjoy the show.
Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
For as long as I can remember, I've suffered from unnerving recurring dreams and night terrors. The How It Ends podcast is an exploration of daily life and the imprint it leaves on our memory and consciousness. This podcast is made by me, Micah Jones, with some help from my two closest friends, Elia Cabral and Devin Williams. I'm not sure where this journey will take me, so follow along as I try to uncover the meaning of my dreams and finally get some sleep. I'm releasing this in real time, so if you're just joining, please start from the beginning, and thank you for listening.
Hey, everyone. So some of you might remember a while back, I had a bit of a freak out at Elia's after we went to Salem. We were hanging out that day, and she showed me a book that she bought the day that we were there. It was called The Field Guide to North American Monsters. And you might remember that that freaked me out a little bit because I found some connection to what I've been dreaming and it related to an entry in that book. So on a whim, I decided to reach out to the author of that book and see if maybe he could tell me a little bit more about the stories that were in it and his inspiration. And lucky for me, he responded. So... That's pretty cool. We've been emailing back and forth a little bit, and I asked him if he would come on the podcast. He is. So please let me introduce you to W. Hayden Blackman, author of The Field Guide to North American Monsters. Hayden?
Hey.
Hey.
Thanks for having me on. I apologize in advance, or I guess it's not in advance anymore, but I apologize that anything in the book would... leave you traumatized, but I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah, I guess I might have been, I think I even said this, that I was a little bit extra that day when I reacted. I think it really struck a chord with me. But, you know, since then, I've been looking into anything and everything that can kind of relate to my dream or, you know, stories about being spooked in the woods or seeing things that may or may not be there. And really, I don't know how to get around it. I really couldn't not ask you about the grinning man. So you didn't really traumatize me so much as my dreams do, but yeah. Yeah. So, sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah. So what, I mean, I'm happy to answer anything I can. And, it's been a while since I wrote the book, but I still have pretty vivid memories of doing the research and some of the conversations I had with folks about some of these kind of monsters and legends and stories that are in there. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah, I guess just to preface before, you know, before we talk about The Grinning Man itself, I want to know what really inspired you to write this book and what got you into the paranormal.
Yeah. So I think for me, it maybe is not unlike some of what you're doing now, except maybe at an earlier age, I had, you know, things that really, really scared me as a kid. I was a pretty cowardly little kid. I had some older brothers that leaned into that pretty hard, I think. And but in order to kind of fight back, I decided to kind of own it and do a lot of research and kind of immerse myself into it, even as a, like, you know, like 9, 10 year old. So I immersed myself into horror movies and the comics and Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, anything I could do that would make all that stuff seem a little less scary and not really knowing why. But through that, I kind of started to discover these stories that bordered on the real, right? And that really fascinated me. So, you know, it's one thing to be afraid of a werewolf or, you know, whatever. But when you start hearing stories about, you know, kind of Bigfoot and the Jersey Devil and Mothman and these other monsters that people felt so sure that they had seen and encountered, that as a 10 and 11 year old really, really kind of captured my imagination. And again, and it was almost as a defense mechanism to not be scared, was to kind of dive deeper and deeper into it. And of course, I don't know if it actually worked. I think it maybe made me more more afraid of this stuff over time, but I couldn't get away from it. It was like, you know, it's that kind of fascination with a car wreck almost, that you have to kind of keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've been experiencing a little bit of that myself. You know, I've been experiencing these dreams, particularly this one that has haunted me for a long time. And for the most part, I stay away from horror. So I kind of did the exact opposite of what you did, just because I naturally just distance myself from it. But ever since I started this podcast, and things seem to just keep falling in my lap, and I can't ignore it now. And now I'm also driven to just want some answers, even if it turns out to be nothing. I just would like some answers, and to find out that maybe it's not just me. So diving right in, when I read through some of the stuff about the Grinning Man, admittedly, the UFO connection didn't really jive with me, but the idea of this thing that haunts paths and trails, particularly in New Jersey, because as I've said in our emails, that's where I'm from. And it was very specific mention in the entry, you know, the idea of this haunting figure scaring people and doing nothing but just staring and watching them really, really unsettles me. So I guess if you can point to any more information about the Grinning Man or what research you did in looking for that particular monster, would be a great place to start.
Sure. So I had not heard about the Grinning Man until I started doing research for this book in particular, even though I had read a ton, you know, kind of previously. But there were other monsters that were similar. I mean, it obviously has some kind of tiebacks or callbacks to, you know, other more traditional boogeymen. There's even, you know, in old folklore, there's characters that do very little more than just stand and stare and kind of lurk around and you know, sometimes are portents of death or are, you know, kind of bad omens, but don't really engage other than just appearing. So so it wasn't strange to find it. What was kind of unsettling for me too were, once you started reading all the firsthand accounts from the 60s of people that you know, claimed to have seen this figure, and it wasn't just in New Jersey. It started there and then kind of spread out and then kind of came back over time. But was the consistency of the reports and the kind of three or four traits that came up again and again and again. So his size, right? And it's not just that he was tall, but also wide and, you know, well over 200 pounds and just almost abnormally large in every way. The fact that he had this kind of green shimmery suit, which, again, given the time period in the 60s and all the UFO sightings and things like that, that might have just been part of the, you know, kind of shared psychoses, or it was in kind of the cultural subconscious at that point. But then it was that smile, right? And that, you don't get that detail with a lot of these other types of characters. Mothman, that's one of the big things with Mothman, was his eyes and his glowing eyes. And although he never really interacted with anybody and just was kind of always hovering or lurking around, it was the eyes. And eyes are a big deal. And sometimes it's the smell or it's a sound, but that smile kept coming up again and again with the grinning man in particular. And that I felt was pretty unusual. So I started to dig into it a little bit more. And then again, I did a few interviews and read a lot of the firsthand accounts. Some people had backed away from kind of what they had seen and weren't really sure anymore. They were young when they had, you know, made the claims, and now they were kind of backing away. But as you kind of dig into it, just that consistency of the smile and the sense of dread that caused and the motionlessness of him just really kind of stuck with me. So that's why he kind of warranted an inclusion in the book. It is a weird thing, though, because it is tied also to that kind of boom of UFO sightings in mm-hmm. the 60s. And there was kind of this craze across the country with you know, UFOs, and then the lingering after effects of people would see, you know, other entities in the area after they had these UFO sightings. So, again, it's hard to know whether or not this is some kind of cultural subconscious thing going on, if it's a mass psychosis, if it's, you know, people hear one story from one area and then they embellish it and, you know, kind of carry it into another area and kind of make it their own. But it was interesting to me that even as the character or the figure moved from kind of state to state and town to town, it had these consistent traits again and again and again.
Yeah, and I think that's really how I'm feeling a little bit right now, because I mean, admittedly, I've just been sort of plagued with this dream where I'm walking in the woods, and I kind of know where I am, and I'm headed in a direction that it feels familiar to me, and I don't necessarily feel unsafe in this part of the dream. And then at some point after walking, I get this feeling that I'm being watched, and every time I turn around in the dream, I immediately wake up. And I think I've said this a couple times on the show that I wake up screaming in a cold sweat. And for years, I just wrote this off as this horrible night terror that, you know, plagued my little kid brain. But when it carried into adulthood, it became more of a nuisance more than anything. And that's really what I thought it was. But when I went to my dad's shed and I looked through his stuff, I came across this message in this book that said, "Don't let Micah see." And then my mom tells me that's what he was saying the night that he died. And that was weird enough. But I think the real clincher here was when I reconnected with a guy named Luke that I met when I was really young, and he sort of filled in the gaps of the day that I met him, of a memory that I can't remember this day. And when he explained to me that I came running out of the woods to his house, that I was all scratched up and completely beside myself, I said, "It saw me." And he said that my friend Amy, who was with him that day, didn't believe me. She thought I was making things up. He didn't know what I meant, and I clearly didn't know what I meant because I didn't even remember it. But he said he believed me because he had an encounter with something, someone, I don't know, in the woods, and it whispered, "I see you," to him. So now, you know, I don't really know what to make of any of that, or if there is anything to make of it. But I guess my curiosity is just getting the better of me, and I kind of have to know. I have to keep looking. So one of the things that I wanted to ask is if you, in your search, if you'd heard anything like that, like, you know, the grinning man, the description really, it brought back the feeling, I think, that dream brings on. But this is a whole different thing, you know. Something spoke to me, supposedly, and something spoke to Luke. Do you have any memory of finding anything like that?
Yeah. So, kind of separating the two things, there's definitely a phenomenon of people feeling watched in the woods, in particular, and this is something that it maybe is even hardwired into us evolutionarily, right? To be right on our guard. And when you're alone in the forest, I mean, I've felt this. And in fact, you know, it's one of the things that I think drove me to want to do some of this research, even as a kid, is, you know, being out on, I went to a camp as a kid, and we were out hiking, and I got separated, and I was off on my own for a little bit. And that sense of dread of feeling like you're being watched. And for me, I actually thought I was heading the right direction and stumbled into this kind of dilapidated, you know, it wasn't even a shack. It was like a house in the middle of nowhere, and kind of went in this little barn area and found all these rats had been kind of strung up through their eyes on ropes, little twined ropes. And it was so, that the sense of
I just
being
got
watched,
chills. Oh my gosh. Right.
Well, so that was one of those like kind of imprint moments, right? It's a memory that really, when you talk about being watched, that's what I remember. I remember this feeling of being watched that drove me to that area. And then when I saw this, and they'd clearly been dead for, you know, they were dry and desiccated and everything. So they'd been there a long time, right? And who knows who had done that, if it was crazy, you know, kids that, you know, were doing it, or if it somebody, you know, some vagrant in the woods or what, I have no idea, right? But I obviously ran, and running, you just feel that sense of I'm being not just watched, I'm being chased, right? And right. Again, I feel like that is a common feeling, even if you don't run into something like a dilapidated barn with, you know, rats strung up in it. But I think that ties into a lot of these things that we see recur in kind of folklore and these urban legend sightings, and even Bigfoot, right? I mean, people feel like they're being watched by Bigfoot, or there's, you know, in lumberjack folklore, there's a character called the Hide Behind, which obviously is meant to be more of a joke, but it's always right behind you. And if you can just turn fast enough and get a glimpse of him, he'll kill you, right? And that is I think, another one of those things that plays on that sense that you're always being watched. And a lot of Native American mythology, there's, you know, spirits or little people, you know, kind of the size of fairies that live in streams or live in the forest that are always watching, right? So that's one part of it. And then there's a subset of that that kind of ties into the voices. And I think that, to me, is almost, it's not as common, but it is almost more powerful and, for me, creepier when I hear those stories. And I did hear quite a few of those when I was doing my research for this book, where people would go, and it was most often in the woods or around caves, outskirts of rural areas, things like that. But people would be out there and they'd have this sense of being watched, and it almost always started with that. And then it would segue into, and then I started hearing things. And at first, everybody's reluctant to say what they heard. They heard, maybe it was just, you know, somebody's voice carrying on the wind. It was kids playing somewhere nearby, or it's, you know, leaves going through the trees. But invariably, eventually they get to the point where they admit, but then I heard words, right? And the thing that always got to me was the repetition of certain phrases, things like go back, stay away, you know, those type, like warnings almost. And that to me, again, gave me chills the third or fourth or fifth time that I heard those stories. And it was hard because I wanted to try and find a way to include them in the book, but they don't attach or pair well with any of the monster stories, right? Like there's not right. any kind of specific things, and they happen everywhere. And that, I think, is the other thing that it's interesting when you look at the folklore and the way that the kind of the monster folklore and the even ghost sightings kind of play out across the country, where on, you know, they're everywhere, first of all. So you do have monster stories everywhere, but you have things like on the East Coast, it's a little bit more kind of ghost sightings and urban legends and, you know, things that clearly the settlers brought over and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas you get into the Midwest and towards the West Coast, it's a lot of the lumberjack folklore, some of which has become more scary than it was intended to over time. It's a lot of the Native American mythology being kind of co-opted and kind of, you know, expanded upon. So there are differences. There's kind of regional differences. But this story of I was being watched and then I heard someone talking to me and I could not pinpoint where the voice was coming for, and it said these things and those specific phrases repeating over and over again, the consistency of that across the country, that I think to me is really chilling and is something that I was never able to answer. Even when, you know, I did a sequel to this book on hauntings and I tried to dig into it a little bit there too, because maybe it was more on that side. Maybe it's more on the kind of the ghost sighting side. And there's just no, you know, kind of one storyline or mythology or folklore or sighting that helps explain that. Whereas, you know, with Bigfoot there is, right? And I can kind of take that. And even though Bigfoot, there are Bigfoot type sightings all over the country, you can ground that in this kind of humanoid thing that maybe has survived and has been in hiding. But this thing, like, who's talking? I don't know. Is it, why are they talking in a language I can understand? And why are they saying these words that the same phrases, regardless of what part of the country they're in? That to me is, I think, something I certainly have never been able to kind of figure out. And I don't know if anybody has an answer for.
Yeah, I didn't even set out to look for any of this. You know, this podcast really started out lighthearted, I think. You know, when me and my friend Elia and my friend Devin, you know, sat down and they spent some time trying to convince me. I think we thought that it would just be something simple. And what it seems to be is that I've sort of ripped the Band-Aid off of a wound that I didn't know that I had. And I think, you know, now, I mean, I'm not sleeping now, and I'm not sleeping as much as I should, and I'm definitely struggling. But like to know that it's not just isolated to one area of the country, you know, not that these kind of things really did permeate stories and folklore is somehow reassuring, because then maybe I might be able to talk to other people and see if they had some sort of similar background to me.
Yeah, I think that's a really valuable exercise, because I do feel like it's like ghost sightings, right? Like when I first got into doing all this research, I thought it was going to be fun. And the field guide to the monsters is kind of tongue in cheek. And you start to dig into it, especially with the ghost stuff, and people, they really believe, and people have had really profound experiences. The one thing I would say, and I don't know if this is, I'm an optimist or what, but that it's not all, it's very rarely does it feel like it's bad. And so I don't know how much of these things are warnings, how much of these things that happen, you know, to people are, you know, really malevolent versus, you know, an encounter that is just misunderstood. So I think the more you can, you know, talk to people that have had shared experiences, and look, everybody has a ghost story. But I found out when I was doing my research, almost everybody has a creepy story about being in the woods. Like, it's not, that is not unusual. And I think finding where those connections maybe can help understand a little bit more to what, you know, for you, what happened, you know, to you and whatever it is that you're trying to sort out.
Yeah. I think that was the other thing too, is that, you know, Luke told me, when he told me his story, I didn't immediately place where he was talking about until he told me it was on River Road, which is actually right across the water, across this brook that runs through Hillsboro from where I was the day that he said I came tearing out of the woods terrified. So we were actually more less than a quarter mile apart, and also a month away from me from, so I don't know, maybe it was some sort of fantastic sort of phenomenon thing that, you know, two kids just, you know, terrified. Although I would like to say for the record and on air, I've actually never been afraid to be in the woods. My dad took me everywhere, and I love hiking. I love being alone, and I've never been afraid to go on long hikes by myself. But that, I think that's starting to change.
Have you done any research into the area around there that is history or understanding anything that might have happened,
you know,
around that brook or anything?
There's a lot of, you know, my hometown in you know, the Somerville, New Jersey area, and Hillsboro, and just New Jersey in general, I'm sure, you know, weird New Jersey started there. We've got a whole host of creep factor stuff, but I've never heard anything like this. The only thing that I remember from growing up there was a story about the pig lady. the pig lady. It had to do with a murder and all this other stuff. But, you know, you're supposed to be able to see her walking on a road in Hillsboro in the surrounding area with an axe, and it's just this woman with a pig head. It's, you know, I think it's kind of right up there with the chupacabra for me.
I mean that's another common story, right? There's in Maryland and around Washington D.C. and stuff. There's the goat man, which is similar, right? He's half man, half goat, and he actually walks around with an axe too. And but I think you know, and again, I don't know how much of this stuff I actually believe, right? It's all
right.
And everybody has to kind of come to their own conclusions. But sometimes, you know, there are people that believe really strongly when something bad happens in an area, there is something left over, you know, that there's some kind of, I call it psychic residue or whatever you want to call it, and that it stays there. And that's, you know, whether that's a battlefield or, you know, a place where a murder happened or somebody disappeared or whatever, that there's something that's still there, that whether it's a true haunting or it's just that kind of after effect, there are people that believe that fervently. And I think, you know, so it couldn't hurt to maybe do a little research about that specific area, but
yeah, that's definitely the plan. I think the thing that's keeping me from diving right into it is that, you know, it's always scarier when it's not a ghost and that it's a person, and
right.
It's some person or some people out there. And I think that, you know, that's a little bit more unnerving to me, is to find out that, like, I'm not making it up, that Luke's not making it up, and that it wasn't a ghost after all. At this point, I would really like for it to be.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would be a lot less terrifying to put it to bed in that sense. No pun intended, because I can't sleep. But,
right.
You know. Yeah.
Well, if it's any consolation, I mean, the grinning man stuff, although, you know, people linked him to kind of a rise in kind of antisocial behavior in the areas where he appeared, and there were reports of spates of violence and, you know, bar fights and things like that around the time that he was spotted in those areas that were, I guess, previously tranquil and didn't have those kinds of problems. You know, there was never any violence directly linked to him, right? There was never any, you know, reports of him attacking anyone directly that I had found. It was more of just that kind of, he's standing there staring at us and grinning at us in this very malevolent, you know, unsettling way, right? And then, you know, people ran and felt like they were being pursued, but who knows how much of that is, you know, was kind of blown out of proportion, right? So.
Right. Well, if that's what it is, I'll take it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I will, because, you know, the path that we've been on has been scary for sure, I think,
yeah.
You know, just, the, you know, based on what he said. And, you know, I actually asked the, you know, people who might be listening to reach out and call me if they have stories. So, I got my fair share of prank calls, but, you know, nothing yet. So maybe I'll have something to report, you know, in the coming weeks.
Well, good luck. I mean, I think, you know, all I can say is in all the research I did, there's definitely stuff out there that we have a hard time explaining and may never explain. So whether, again, that's ghost sightings or the, you know, that kind of the consistency of sightings of things like Mothman or the Grinning Man, where across multiple sightings, across multiple locations, the descriptions were so similar. I applaud you for continuing to do the research, though, because, again, the more we can kind of dive into this stuff, hopefully the more we know about ourselves and about the world around us, and, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that my sort of mantra right now is just to keep looking.
Yep.
So that's what I'll have to do. And thank you again for, you know, responding to my email. You have a very illustrious career, and I know that you're taking out a lot of time to talk to me. And I have to say thank you for being on my tiny little podcast from Providence.
No, I really appreciate it. I mean, the book is the first thing that I ever wrote and published. And again, it was a long time ago, but I have a real soft spot for it. So I was ecstatic to hear that, you know, you guys were actually sharing it and reading it and, you know, had.
Yeah, my friend Elliot loves it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad for that. And I think, again, it was meant to be kind of tongue in cheek, but there's a lot of cool stuff out there for, I think, people to explore. And, I don't know. I'm glad that it brought some joy there. And if it helps kind of put you on the right path to figuring out some of the stuff that happened, then that's, you know, even better. So.
Yeah, thank you again, guys. I've been talking to W. Hayden Blackman, and he's the best, for letting me give him a call. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.